Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, wait a minute. We are a year and a half into this recession. 8 months and nobody really knows how many trillions of dollars into bailing out everybody. And today, Ben Bernanke says he's worried about deficits. Where's he been? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 3rd of June. Great to have you with us. You know, when Ben Bernanke decides to make news, he doesn't really pull any punches, does he? The chairman of the Fed was on Capitol Hill today, and he used his moment in the spotlight to warn Congress about the growing budget deficit. Washington is going to shell out almost $2 trillion more than it takes in this year. Of course, all that spending was meant to rescue the U.S. economy from disaster, and there are signs that some of the money may be doing what it was supposed to do. So this morning's pronouncements by the Fed chairman prompt this question. Why such a deficit hawk now? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Bernanke warned members of Congress today that all their stimulus spending could eventually hurt the economy.
Even as we take steps to address the recession and threats to financial stability, maintaining the confidence of the financial markets requires that we as a nation begin planning now for the restoration of fiscal balance.
By confidence of the financial markets, Bernanke means confidence that U.S. Treasuries remain good long-term investments. Lately, bond investors have started worrying that all that deficit spending could lead to higher inflation. They also worry that all the borrowing could make the U.S. government less creditworthy. So as the Treasury sells more long-term bonds, it's having to pay higher interest rates. Axel Merck is president of Merck Investments. He says the Fed is counting on low interest rates to jumpstart the housing market and revive the economy.
The best thing that the Fed can do is try to talk down interest rates, talk some calm into the market so that the cost of borrowing doesn't soar.
Today, Bernanke downplayed any concerns about inflation. But in the last few months, market predictions of inflation have jumped. Guy Lebas is a strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
In reality, one of the best indicators we have about future inflation is the market's expectations of inflation. So I'm quite sure the Fed was watching those figures.
You have to remember, Bernanke's job is to keep inflation at bay. Sometimes that means managing expectations. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Just for some context here, one of the most common measurements of inflation, the Consumer Price Index, unchanged in April. That is the most recent month that we've got data for. General Motors CEO Fritz Henderson was on Capitol Hill today, too. He said once again that the company just has too many dealerships out there to support sharply lower sales. In that vein, thousands of GM dealers got letters this week with what you could fairly call an ultimatum inside. GM has apparently given them a choice, either give up control over a lot of their businesses or shut them down. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
John McElhaney is a GM dealer from Clinton, Iowa.
A lot of communities like where I'm from, medium-sized towns, and closing a car dealership was almost like closing an assembly plant. We're one of the largest private employers.
McElhaney was fortunate. GM told him his dealership could stay open, but he'd have to sign a new contract. And as chair of the National Association of Auto Dealers, he's hearing GM is demanding a lot more control over dealerships everywhere.
They can require dealers to carry more inventory. They can require dealers to make massive facility investments or relocate.
Or lose their franchise. But analysts say GM has too many dealers. And before GM's bankruptcy this week, state franchise laws gave dealers too much control over how they ran their businesses and made it tough to close them down.
The franchising laws had the auto companies in a box.
John Wolkanowicz follows the auto industry for IHS Global Insight.
Literally, you couldn't cancel a franchise unless the franchisee was convicted of committing a crime.
So when GM killed Oldsmobile, it had to spend $2 billion buying out its dealers. Wolkanowicz says now it'll have a lot more flexibility, but
it's not like the GM brands are so desirable.
So GM will still have to play nice with its dealers, or
they might say, this is too much trouble. I can sell Toyotas, to hell with you.
And the only thing worse than too many dealers is too few. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Microsoft is betting big on its new search engine, Bing, it's called. The company's $100 million advertising campaign debuts tonight. It is their latest and most expensive attempt to unseat Google as the king of search. And if they succeed, even modestly, Microsoft might have one of its other big rivals to thank for the inspiration. Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports now on what the software giant has learned from being uncool.
Ever since Google became synonymous with search, the company has been untouchable. Now Microsoft hopes to change that with a new product called Bing and a splashy ad campaign that casts Google as cumbersome and dated.
We don't need queries and keywords if they bring back questions and confusion. From this moment on, search overload is officially over.
Starting today, technology analyst Rob Enderle says Microsoft is attempting to do to Google what Apple so successfully did to Microsoft with its I'm a Mac, I'm a PC campaign. Portray it as inferior.
Microsoft has to first make people dissatisfied with Google search before they can get them to move. And the first phase of this advertising campaign is to a large extent designed to do that.
The question is whether that'll be enough to make people switch. Microsoft's last redesign, Live Search, flopped. Enderle says Bing could be different. That's because it produces more detailed and useful information than Google in the initial search.
Bing does seem to provide the promise, or at least fulfill the promise that it makes, even in this early phase. And the end result is, coupled with good marketing, they may in fact actually take an impressive amount of share.
That is, until Google fires back with an upgrade and multi-million-dollar marketing campaign of its own. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Search Dow Industrials today on Bing or whatever search engine you like. The numbers are going to be all red. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Early on the morning of June 4th, 1989, Chinese soldiers moved into Tiananmen Square. The crackdown in Beijing put an end to months of pro-democracy protests there. Some estimates say thousands of people were killed. But in some ways, the events of that night got China started on the chaotic economic ride it has been on since. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the line from Shanghai. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
The conversation, it seems, Scott, about China is always about this enormous pace of change, how quickly things are happening over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if you could give us some idea of how different it is, really, from 20 years ago.
Well, Kai, I spoke to some students who were on the square and demonstrating at various campuses across China back in 1989. And one of them told me, you know, 20 years ago, I was a very hungry student. I went to university and I got a voucher of one meal with meat per day. And that's all they got. Fast forward to today, and he and I live in the same apartment complex, and just down the street, you have Cold Stone Creamery, the bastion of Western civilization,
mm-hmm.
right? And you go in there, and they ask if you want the frequent customer discount card. You can call it materialism, call it getting ahead, call it economic development, but life is undoubtedly better by those metrics than 20 years ago, and that's where China's at.
And yet, 20 years ago, it was all politics. How did it change so dramatically?
Scholars who analyze the Communist Party say back in 1989, that was the low point for the party. And if you think about it, after the crackdown, you had the Berlin Wall falling. It was a tumultuous time for authoritarian states around the world. So the leader of China, Deng Xiaoping, and the elites in the party, they went back to the economic playbook. And they said, we're going to establish our political legitimacy by making people's lives better. You know, the business of China is business. And basically, the deal was the same deal that Ronald Reagan trotted out when he was running for president. Is your life better than it was 4 years ago? Better than it was 20 years ago? And, you know, for the vast majority of people in China, the answer is, duh, of course it's better.
Is there, obviously not around the anniversary itself, but is there any dissent over there from these viewpoints?
Well, the dissidents are quietly in China or they're loudly outside of China. And what they say is, if you think about this China economic model, it's not a sustainable model because it is rotten at its core. What they argue is corruption is a central hallmark of what's happening in China. And here's a way for you and I to think about it. Imagine every member of Congress, of 535 important people in the U.S. and the whole cabinet, they get a special half price on cars or food or consumer products or whatever. So they get that special price, and then they turn around and sell it to you and me for full price, and they pocket the difference personally. Well, that's the kind of corruption that brought a lot of the students out in the first place. And it, the same kind of corruption is all over China today. And eventually something is going to give.
Well, if there's one group that says it's not sustainable, but a larger group that says, you know what, I want what I want when I want it, and I can get it in China today, what are you and I going to be talking about in 20 years?
The smart money says China is going to rival the U.S. as the world's biggest economy, and that the Communist Party is still going to be on top. Over the years, it's adapted to the new wealth that has come to China. And most people think it'll keep adjusting and stay in power that way.
Yeah. You know, Deng Xiaoping lived long enough to see a lot of the changes that he set in motion. He died, what, 10 or 12 years ago. Would he recognize China today if he were still around?
Well, there are a couple phrases that many people think Deng Xiaoping said when he was in power. And one of them was, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a black cat or a white cat, so long as it catches mice. And that is, you know, our ideology is pragmatism. Whatever works is what we're going to do. And so, in a way, he knew that the China of 97 was going to be different from the China of 2007, 2017, etc.
Scott Tong at the Bureau in Shanghai. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Kai.
Like every other country that's caught up in the global recession, France is trying to boost its economy. It's got the usual infrastructure projects and jobs programs, but France being France, there's food and wine involved, too. Call it the cocktail party stimulus plan, if you like. Sally Herships reports.
Belinda Chang is sommelier at The Modern, a pricey French restaurant in New York. Every night, she chooses the right wine to go with entrees like monkfish, squab, and foie gras. Tomorrow night, she's throwing a cocktail party in her own home. But this time, the French government will be picking the wine and picking up the tab.
Drink more? Vive la France?
That's the message that Chang will deliver to her guests. So will hosts across the country. It's all part of French Cocktail Hour, a $2 million effort by the French government. 15,000 guests at private parties around the U.S. will be plied with French liquor and hors d'oeuvres. Marie-Noëlle Guérin is with Sopexa, the marketing firm behind the parties.
We were tending to get a reputation of being kind of elitist, too sophisticated, too expensive, too complicated.
Guérin says the hope is the intimate events will make French cuisine more popular, as well as demystify it. While wine sales in the U.S. are going up, sales of French bottles have plateaued. So even though the French government has been hosting the cocktail hour for 6 years, this is the first time parties will be held in private homes.
It's about sharing a good moment together. It's a French atmosphere.
To create that atmosphere, hosts have been given decorations, a corkscrew, and a CD by singer-turned-French First Lady Carla Bruni. And then there are the drinks. Beers, liqueurs, and wines, including Lucien Albrecht Pinot Gris Reserve Romanus. No wonder the French think we're mystified. There's also plenty of French cheese with names I won't even try to pronounce. Again, sommelier Belinda Chang.
I think it's going to be really fun to see how my friends respond to having really cool aperitifs and cocktails. Perhaps now is not the time for a really expensive bottle of vintage champagne.
Champagne? There's always next year for that. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, unemployed and unequal.
In some states, it may be 2/3 of all unemployed workers are getting benefits. In some states, it's less than 1 out of 4.
But first, let's do the numbers. A bad day got better, but not good enough to sustain the rally. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.75%, 65 points, closed at 8,675. The NASDAQ retreated 0.5%, 10 points, ended at 1,825. The S&P 500 unloaded 1.33%. That's 12 points, wrapped up at 931. Oil prices fell. Crude is at $67 a barrel now, and you know what happens when that happens. Energy shares tumbled across the board. ExxonMobil and Chevron both siphoned off more than 1%. ConocoPhillips gave up close to 5%. On the financial front, Citigroup fell nearly 3.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 1.5%. Bank of America lost 1.67%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department lets us know whether workers were more productive during the first quarter. Are Americans spending? The nation's major retailers announce sales figures for May. And a Senate subcommittee on disaster recovery holds a hearing on emergency preparedness for the 2009 hurricane season. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The scandal over parliamentary expense reports continues to work its way through British politics. Lawmakers over there claimed everything from the cost of cleaning a moat to renting pornography as reimbursable expenses. Over the past 2 days, two cabinet ministers have quit, and there are now some doubts that British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is going to be able to keep his job. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The two ministers jumped before they were pushed. Both had made dodgy claims on their parliamentary expenses. Both had been tipped to lose their jobs in a cabinet reshuffle expected on Friday. In an unprecedented move, they got in first and said they were quitting ahead of a set of elections tomorrow. Two junior ministers joined the exodus. In the bear pit of the House of Commons, an opposition leader, Nick Clegg, put the boot in.
The Prime Minister is thrashing around, fighting for his own political survival. But does he not understand the extreme danger to our democracy when people start feeling that there's simply no one in charge?
It's now widely believed that Gordon Brown wants to replace his most important minister, the finance chief, in Friday's reshuffle. He's also been tainted by the expenses scandal. The fear is this political turmoil may soon undermine efforts to pull Britain out of its worst financial downturn in decades. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Barney Frank said yesterday he wants new regulations for the finance industry out of his committee by the end of July. Frank gets to decide these kinds of things because he's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. The White House, meanwhile, is working on its version of the new rules. They could be sent up to Capitol Hill as early as next week. Commentator Robert Reich offers his recommendation.
America got into its current financial mess partly because big banks and other financial companies did regulatory arbitrage. They gamed the system to find the most lenient regulator and invented derivatives no one regulated, such as collateralized debt instruments, which have so far cost you and me and other taxpayers $170 billion. What's needed is a single overarching regulator to replace the current patchwork that now includes the Comptroller of the Currency, Office of Thrift Supervision, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Securities and Exchange Commission, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, state bank regulators, and a myriad of state insurance authorities. The only public institution with enough prestige and power to do the job is the Federal Reserve, America's central bank. Yet the Fed has one big problem. Much of the Fed's supervisory work is done by its regional banks. And who chooses those regional Fed presidents? Bankers, foxes guarding hen houses. Earlier this month, Stephen Friedman, chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, stepped down after questions about potential conflicts because he was also a director of Goldman Sachs. If the Fed is going to be the nation's financial overseer-in-chief, it can no longer be an old boys' club of bankers. That means more public accountability. Yet, if it's going to continue to be America's central bank, it's also got to stay independent of partisan politics. How to accomplish both? For one, more openness. The Fed's regulatory decisions have to be on the record, not ad hoc and confidential. And it should disclose every company receiving its loans. Its budget and expenditures should also be transparent and audited. Second, the Fed's regional presidents should be appointed by the U.S. president and confirmed by the Senate. America has to know who these people are and trust they'll act in the public's interest. Finally, the Fed chair should serve a maximum of 8 years. No more Alan Greenspans, who reign forever because they have so much power no president dares get rid of them.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Your thoughts are always welcome. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. When we get the May unemployment report Friday morning, it's probably going to show the economy has lost another 500,000 jobs. Conventional wisdom is that once somebody gets a pink slip, they go down to the local unemployment office and file for benefits, and many do. But there ends the broad generalization. How much somebody gets in a weekly unemployment check, or even whether they're eligible at all, depends a lot on where they live. Today, we start a series on unemployment compensation, produced in conjunction with the investigative newsroom ProPublica. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
The first stop on my tour of state unemployment systems is South Carolina. It's been hurting in this recession. Its unemployment rate is the third worst in the nation, 11.5%. The city of Greenville has seen many of its textile mills close. Now the auto parts plants that replace them are cutting back.
Right, so we're learning words, which are parts of speech, and we're going to learn how to make really good sentences with those words.
Some of the locals who get pink slips end up here at Greenville's Free Literacy Center.
March 19th was my last day of work. I didn't even know it was coming. No notice or anything.
Anthony Carbajal is 29. He's compact and powerful. It's easy to imagine him in his old job, welding metal crates for John Deere lawnmowers. But these days, Carbajal spends most of his time studying for his GED. He has house payments to make and three kids to support, all on his weekly unemployment check.
I'm getting $332 a week.
How does that compare to what you were making?
Oh, no, not good.
Now he's taking home 40% less. Next, let's jump across the country to Oregon. It has the second worst unemployment in the country. I met Michael Diamond at a Portland coffee shop. He's also a welder with three kids to support. He used to make rail cars, but 2.5 months ago, he got laid off. Diamond was making nearly $600 a week.
And when I'm on unemployment, it's about $425.
Let's run those numbers again. Two skilled workers whose paychecks differed by about $50. On unemployment, the South Carolina welder takes home
$332 a week.
The Oregon welder
$425.
It really matters what state you live in. The levels of benefits vary extremely wildly.
That's Andrew Stettner of the National Employment Law Project. He says it's not just how much you get that's all over the map.
In some states, it may be two-thirds of all unemployed workers are getting benefits. In some states, it's less than one out of four.
This patchwork has existed since the New Deal, when unemployment insurance was first introduced. To get the plan through, states were allowed to set their own rules on key items like how they calculate benefit amounts and who's eligible. There are states where you can quit your job, you can even be fired, and still draw benefits. In other states, you have to be laid off for strictly economic reasons. And the discrepancies in benefits can really slam middle-class professionals. In low-paying states like Nebraska and Louisiana, laid-off workers cap out around $300 a week on unemployment, no matter how much they used to make. In New Jersey and Minnesota, they'd get double that. Even after accounting for cost-of-living differences, that spread is wide. In Oregon, Michael Diamond's unemployment check is pretty good by national standards, but he complains it doesn't go very far.
There's no way to survive on that. The bills alone for the rent or the house payments and the electric and the utilities, and with the car and the insurance, you know, it's almost impossible.
Which is one reason the federal government is pushing states to boost benefits. Oregon's received millions in stimulus money to put more low-income workers on the rolls, and residents can keep getting checks longer now if they can't find a job. South Carolina's governor rejected that stimulus offer from the feds. Many South Carolina political and business leaders share his opposition to making more people eligible for unemployment. They don't want to plow extra money into what they think sometimes functions as a shadow welfare system for people who can't find steady work.
How you been?
Sarah Googe and her husband have run a feed and seed store in the small town of Fairfax for three decades.
Well, we sell baby chicks. We also sell a full line of garden supplies.
Googe says business is pretty good right now, despite the fact that nearly one in four people in this rural county are unemployed. She says locals often come in asking her to certify they've applied for a job so they can stay on unemployment.
And I go, you're not even looking for a job. Why should I sign it? I mean, this happens every week. I say if they don't have a job, give them a shovel and a hoe and a sack of seed.
Soon, Googe may get her way. South Carolina's unemployment system is $350 million in debt from paying benefits in the deepening recession. So it may have to raise business taxes or boot people from the rolls at the worst possible time for the local economy. More on that story tomorrow. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Thanks to Olga Pierce at ProPublica for her work on that story. To find out what kind of unemployment benefits your state offers, ProPublica has put together an interactive map. There's a link to it on our website. Also, slideshow profiles of unemployed workers in Oregon and South Carolina. It's online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the housing market has caught up with Secretary of the Treasury. You might remember that before he got his current job, Timothy Geithner was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He commuted into the city from the suburbs where he owned a house. A house that hasn't sold since he put it on the market when he got promoted. So he's a landlord now, the Treasury Secretary is. The house was rented out late last month for $7,500 a month. According to the Associated Press, that's probably still not enough to cover his $1.25 million mortgage plus taxes. That is Marketplace, though, from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 65 points, 3/4%. The NASDAQ dipped 10 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 lost 12 points, 1/3%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, how strong are those state social safety nets?
We were paying out roughly $5 million a week, and suddenly it jumped to $10 million a week in benefits. And the more we paid out, the less money we had in our trust fund.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. We'll be right back.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.